the Velvet Studio, Ottawa's queer media. I am Luke Smith, and we are good to go on our new episode. So we have lots of people with me here today. Do you want to all introduce yourself?
Ooh, shit.
Sure. I'm Angus McIsaac.
I'm Sebastian.
And I'm Dylan Black.
Okay, I'm just going to try and figure out where everybody is. Okay, so yeah, no, today's topic is going to be looking at post-gay, which is pretty exciting, and post-gay relates to actually a number of things. There's lots of different things which it can mean. Now, both Angus and Sebastian have some of the definitions of what that could be.
It's all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
It's true. It is. Do you want to kick it off?
Yeah, I was just going to say, so when I was doing a little bit of research last night as well, I had come up with, there was an article on Queerty that spoke about Exodus, and the and those are the ex-gay folks, and basically spoke to the idea that they switched from using the term ex-gay because it was more referencing the idea that somebody was gay and then turned straight, was cured, which has never happened. So, and now they sort of adopted post-gay, which is to speak more of the ideology of moving beyond sexuality and, I guess, doing what's right in terms of the church. So that was one of the definitions that I had come up with anyways.
Mm-hmm. And my familiarity actually stems from when I used to live in Toronto. I had a friend who was doing research on the bear community of Toronto. And he divided the community into traditional bears, post-gay bears, and post-post-gay bears. But what he would call post-post-gay, other people would just call post-gay. And then the post-gay would be, I don't know, it's all over the place. There's dialogue behind it, but we'll get to that shortly. But broadly speaking, the idea of someone who's post-gay is someone who's over the fact that they're gay. Like, it's they either don't include it into their identity or they reject it as being a part of their identity. It's just this thing that they do. It's not who they are. And so you can get a whole range of things falling into there. So you can get that sort of gay bro dude, I'm not a gay man, I'm just a homosexual who likes sports and trucks kind of identity. Or you can have people who are active in the gay community but who don't let that define who they are. But then even that, like, it can go a whole bunch of different directions.
One of my things, you know, I really wanted us to establish that what we're going to be talking about is more along the lines of people who are post-gay in that they're over being gay, and there's a lot of reasons why people have that. There's a lot of politics involved. For example, after the success of gay marriage in Canada, we saw an increase in the post-gay movement. People were like, "Oh, well, we've done our job. Okay, let's go home. Let's get married. 2.5 children and a white picket fence. Here we go." And that's kind of a lot of where that came out of as well. And we might be seeing that emerge in the States, so it could be a cautionary tale. And now what we're seeing now is post-gay in Canada, where people have done the okay, not that yep. gay, and now they're coming back into the queer community.
So my friend who was researching the bears, he defined post-post-gay as people who are over being over it. Mm-hmm. And so people who are post-post-gay fit both into the gay world and into the post-gay world, because it doesn't define who they are, but it also doesn't not define who they are. They're okay with it being a part of who they are, but they're more than that. So it's this weird, but then what the post-post-gay bears would just be normal post-gay and the rest of the gay community. It's really a quagmire, partly yeah. because it's not part of the standard like language in the community, that it hasn't gelled into anything.
And I'm sure we'll touch base about it, but I also think that part of what creates that post-gay factor is the sort of structures that we have in the community. Like, you know, do you want to go to the same bar that's been there for the last 30 years mm-hmm. and everybody's standing in the same place and they're playing the same music and they're having the same theme nights? Or is there just the shift away from doing that?
We've also got the sort of cultural structures, I guess you could call it, the food groups of the, well, gay male world anyway. And they touched on that in the towards the end of Looking, while it was still going, about how it was all horrible stereotypes and, you know, you're a twink or you're a bear or you're a daddy, and then everyone, like, a lot of people are just looking at that going, but there's like 20 people in the city who actually fits into any of these. This is ridiculous. Like, yes, there are archetypes, and archetypes exist for a reason. It's how we see the world. I mean, a lot of fairy tales are mostly just archetypes, and there's something positive to be said about archetype theory, because you can learn a lot about the world in very quick order, but it's not, there's way more nuance to it than that, and we need to move beyond that. And it's really weird, because the culture is made out of people, and the people in the culture are progressing, but the culture's not. It's this bizarre sort of, you know, we're getting progressive and yet we're cemented at the same time, and it's this really weird dynamic that's it's hard to explain, but you know what I mean, though, right? Like, the culture is gelled, even though most of the people you speak to are like, yeah, this is stupid, we need to move beyond this, but...
Yeah, we still... Well, I think we get sort of in the same patterns, and so it is still all there, but I think the need for it is different now. So, like, it used to be once upon a time, I'm a certain age, 39, and I remember, you know, you'd want to identify with the bear community because you felt so isolated, whereas now we're in a time where that isolation... maybe isn't such an issue. So it's still like there's still all of those identities, and there are so many identities, but the need for them is maybe changed and evolved, but the patterns haven't in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm just thinking about this as it's going along, and I'm kind of wondering, like, who are the folks who are using these terms to kind of conceptualize themselves, right? Because I think there's a lot of other folks who embody different experiences and different, like, subjectivities and different, like, identities, and who experience different forms of, like, oppression. And I don't necessarily know that those folks would identify with, like, this post-gay, I guess, theory or identity, because a lot of folks are still struggling to even, like, have access to those spaces. So for me, it's like, I feel like in a way there's, like, a weird power dynamic, or like in terms of privilege and oppression, that plays out in those kinds of conversations, because it's kind of like who are the folks who are controlling, like, most of the, like, symbolism in our culture? Who are the folks who have most access to those spaces, who are creating those spaces, and then who are the folks who are more marginalized in those spaces themselves too, right? So I mean, I wonder about this post-gay thing, and, you know, we're talking about marriage equality, but, you know, most of the folks who even have access to marriage equality or think that that's an important framework right now is generally, like, white cis, like, kind of queer
middle
or
upper class.
Middle upper class, yeah. You know, LG type folks in the LG movement, and a lot of other folks are kind of like, oh, you know, that's not necessarily a priority for me. Like, I'm fucking starving, or like, I'm homeless, or like, you know, like, trans folks, like, don't have access to, like, anything, right? So it's kind of like, I really wonder who's controlling, like, the narrative around those spaces. So it's just interesting for me as I'm kind of listening to you and I'm going along. It's a bit of a new term for me, but it's kind of like, you know, when we talk about post-colonialism, like, how can we be in a post-colonial world when colonialism is still very much alive and well? So you know, like, homophobia is alive and well, transphobia is alive and well. So it's interesting for me to kind of think about, you know, what does post-gay look like when we're all experiencing that violence still anyway, right?
Well, and it's almost like and I think that's why I really like that you're here too on the subject, because it, you know, in terms of what I was saying, I think for people who identify as gay or lesbian, like, we've come so far that we have the luxury of adopting something like post-gay, because our rights are sort of being more respected now. Whereas when you look now at the trans community, they are the ones that are sort of, I want to say, almost 10 or 15 years behind, or even more, in terms of acceptance and in terms of the public even being educated about what that means, you know? So that's why I mean, it means different things to different people. So there's almost like, I don't know, I think in some ways when you look and you see all these identifications and how people identify with, like, the bears and the cubs and the otters and stuff, it almost seems like fluff compared to what some people are actually really dealing with on a day in, day out.
Well, privilege does actually get into it quite a deal, because some people identify as post-gay because they have the privilege to do so. Mm-hmm. They don't need the community. They don't need that safety net. They come from a family that accepts them. They're middle class. You know, if they come out as gay and the gay world doesn't accept them, you know, whoop-de-doo. They've got this other life that they can rely on. And it's just totally fine. They don't need the community like people did in the past, where it was, you know, their adopted family, where if anything happened, it wasn't, you know, their blood relatives who came rushing to help them. It would be people they had met throughout the community. Or you also have a lot of people in sort of post-gay circles who have zero access to that privilege because they're non-white, they're non-cis, they're not from middle-class families. And so for them to be post-gay, it's just a rejection of the gay identity because they don't fit into those food groups. Mm-hmm. You know, like maybe they are Asian, but they're not that stereotypical pocket gay Asian. They're a professional athlete and they like camping, and they look at it and they're like, you know, strictly speaking, I would fit into jock, but the traditional
There's a racist connotation.
Yeah. They can't fit into that thing that they actually fit into perfectly because of one aspect. And so they're just like, well, screw it. I'm done with the system. I'm going to be this other, you know, I'm over it because they can't fit in. And so you have these two sort of different dynamics where, you know, they reject it because they have the freedom to. And then the other is they reject it because there's not really many other options.
Yeah.
I mean, this is an incredibly nuanced and privileged terminology. I mean, if you look at conversations that are being had in, you know, I was, for example, let's say like St. John, New Brunswick, you know, tiny, tiny town compared, like 50,000, I think it is, or 90,000, I forget which. And, you know, they're not really having conversations about being post-gay because they're struggling to have a gay bar. Like, they're struggling to find a commonality. So I think it comes from a place where people are incredibly privileged, and it comes from a place where they're ignoring who is already excluded from those spaces. Like you were saying about the same people in the same corners drinking the same drinks or the same music at, like, you know, the local gay pub, but there are some people who would feel incredibly unsafe in those gay pubs and in those environments. And for the longest time, a lot of gay pubs were incredibly misogynistic as well.
Absolutely. Like, I think, and I'm even thinking about it, like, as we go along, like, I did my thesis work on, like, queer and trans youth suicide. And one of the things that's really interesting to me is that, you know, you have this group of youth who are experiencing all these mental health issues and who are, like, considering that as an option in their lives. And a lot of it has to do with not being able to even conceptualize themselves as real or valid or, like, in a part of this world. So for us to kind of have this other community of folks who are like, oh, like, I'm totally over that is, like, a really interesting dynamic, right? So, and yes, there's definitely a lot of misogyny in queer spaces. Like, that is something, you know, like, as a non-binary, like, feminist person, like, I often go, you know, to the Lookout on Friday nights, and I'm like, wow, like, what is it about, like, our culture that keeps kind of attaching ourselves to these, like, heteronormative, like, oppressive ideas, right? And even with, like, you know, marriage equality and, like, all these systems that we keep relying on, and a lot of trans people often feel like that rights framework isn't necessarily, like, the best way to go, because oftentimes we just end up recreating those same structures and we're not actually challenging them. And we keep recreating these, you know, these subjects and these, like, power dynamics. And, like, you know, it's okay for us to be queer, but we're going to, like, be misogynistic towards each other, which is, like, really messed up to me, right? So I think that's definitely, like, an issue that we should also kind of be bringing into the forefront when we're talking about these issues in our spaces. Mm-hmm.
Well, and it seems to me as well, like, when you look at just even with the recent thing in the U.S. there, where everybody can get married in all 50 states now, and then it seems like the shift then goes towards our trans community, because, you know, you look at somebody like Caitlyn
Jenner,
who, you know, you see all these memes going around and all these, and it's using humor and all of this. But at the end of the day, it's almost like we tend to, we get acceptance. So then we kind of turn our backs on those who haven't, had that, the luck, I guess, to have that, as well. So it's interesting what we tend to do to each other in terms of segregating and isolating.
It really bothered me the way that kind of unfolded, You know, the idea that, oh, you know, the Americans have really come together, and a lot of Canadian activists, well, a lot of Canadian members of the community were fully in support, and they were like, okay, well, now marriage is done. Okay, let's pick another minority and let's work with them, you know. And it implies that they're almost like second best or second on the list, and that is completely the wrong way to go about this. I mean, we should be continuing to fight injustices in multiple levels. You know, we're still at the highest percentage of youth homelessness is GLBT identified. You know, and that results from, for example, homophobia in the home. You know, if we haven't tackled homophobia in the home, which leads to higher rates of GLBT homelessness, then getting, you know, equality to fly around is, we need to come at it in multiple approaches, not just, you know, do one, you know, wash our hands of that and move on to the next topic.
Yeah. And like for me, like a lot of times we often focus really on like identity based kind of movements and like issues. And I think it's super important. I think identity is like a very important like factor in our lives. And I think people can, you know, identify in similar ways, but also experience that in very different ways. And I think the complexity of that is just like a really beautiful thing. But at the same time, I'm kind of like, you know, we need to be pushing towards like looking at the ways in which different bodies and different identities and different like communities are being controlled and like surveyed or policed in different ways, right? Because it, you know, even if I identify as someone who's gender nonconforming, like I still experience like misogyny and sexism in the same way that like I know queer men who experience sexism and misogyny, in the same way that I know like hetero women. So I think there are issues and like pieces that we could kind of say, hey, like we're all experiencing this structure in different ways, but how do we work together and come together to kind of challenge those structures, right? Mm-hmm. So I think for me, it's like kind of moving towards like, you know, a different way to do like solidarity work, a different way to kind of combat these issues, recognizing that we have different experiences, but knowing that they're kind of coming from those same places. Like, you know, I work in the field of violence against women, but I know that, you know, like trans and queer men and people who are feminine in certain ways, that they're experiencing that violence from those systems. And I think they all kind of are rooted in the same places. And I think we as a community need to kind of move towards that and kind of like look at that as different issues instead of solely focusing on like different people's identities and mm-hmm. what they need and those issues in terms of like rights and that kind of stuff.
Well, and assuming that just because gay marriage is now, you know, it's in now an equal thing, that automatically implies that goes towards all the other communities as well. Like, I think a lot of people just assume that, okay, well, we all win.
Yeah,
but
totally.
No, we don't.
We'll be talking about that in more detail in just a few minutes. Next up is Keza Stronger, and this is on the soundtrack to the Finding Neverland play on Broadway.